I've said this other places publicly, other than my faith and my wife, nobody's had more of an impact on me than Tony Robbins. So he became a client without me having anything to do with it. Actually, he was referred to us by a friend of his who used to work for Paul Tudor Jones, and he became an investor. And then, again, big shock to me, it was kind of cool. But then ultimately, he wanted to meet me because he really loved what we did. Wow. And what we do. And so that led to a meeting, a 14-hour meeting, actually, where he learned a lot more about our business and decided to ultimately become a shareholder in the firm.
Welcome to Wealth Channel. Listen in as host Andy Higgins talks with the smartest and most connected people in the world of finance. Take a deep dive with us as we explore the topics that matter most to protect and grow your wealth. It's all right here on Wealth Channel.
Welcome to the show. I'm Andy Higgins. You know, most investors, even relatively unsophisticated ones, are aware that there's a different way that the ultra wealthy do investing. And that's true whether we're talking about institutional investors like endowments and pension funds, or the world's family offices and ultra wealthy investors. Well, how about Tony Robbins and all of the billionaires in his social circle? Well, Tony Robbins and our guest today, Christopher Zook, who's a very successful investor in his own right, have joined together, they've joined forces to write a new book that was just released today as we record this, that's all about the strategies that the world's ultra wealthy use to achieve above average returns in good markets and in bad. Christopher, welcome to the show. This topic is so fun.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoy talking about it and look forward to the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, all of these topics that are in the book are near and dear to my heart. And you know, I want to get to the book and all of the themes and strategies and tactics inside the book. But my first question for you, it's a burning question. How did you originally meet Tony Robbins?
The story is quite interesting because of the fact that it started 33 years ago with a very, very young me person working late, a year out of school, and I saw this massive human being come on TV and talk about a tape series that I could get, and I ordered it, and it was back on cassette tapes when we had those things. And Lisa, my wife, and I did that tape series for 30 days. And one of the nights, you actually do a goal-setting workshop. And in that particular situation, I set a goal to within 10 years to start my own firm by the name of Kaz Investments. And 9 years, 9 months later, I actually started the firm. And of course, I don't think those two are accidents. I don't think that's a coincidence. That is what I set my outcome towards. And then fast forward a little bit more, and I'd attended a couple of Tony's live events. It had a massive impact on my life. I've said this other places publicly, other than my faith and my wife, nobody's had more of an impact on me than Tony Robbins. So he became a client without me having anything to do with it. Actually, he was referred to us by a friend of his who used to work for Paul Tudor Jones, and he became an investor. And then, again, big shock to me, it was kind of cool, but then ultimately he wanted to meet me because he really loved what we did. Wow. And what we do. And so that led to a meeting, a 14-hour meeting, actually, where he learned a lot more about our business and decided to ultimately become a shareholder in the firm. So now we're releasing a book together. We've become very, very close. And it is definitely surreal to think about how much has changed over the last 33 years. And I'm very honored to be his partner and his friend.
Well, Christopher, you're inspiring me now. I'm like, well, that's a life goal to be a person that Tony Robbins wants to meet me. You know, that's a pretty incredible thing. So this initial meeting was 14 hours. I mean, I get the presence. I'm a Tony Robbins fan as well, maybe a more casual fan, but he's very magnetic, and I think he's very insightful. And to your point, even how physically, you know, tall he is and everything, is he an overwhelming kind of a presence in person, or how would you describe that initial meeting?
So he is an overwhelming presence in person. He's 6'7", and he's, you know, a massive human being. Mm-hmm. So you know, his physical presence is strong. His intensity is a level that really very few people have. And not in a bad way. It can be at times where he's very intense and it doesn't feel great, but it's intense and just, you know, about life and about passion and just, you know, living your life according to what you really want to accomplish. So he is very much an imposing figure, but he also has such a great heart, and he just loves people, and he just wants to serve. And that's something that really he doesn't get enough credit for, in my opinion, because they see the stuff that's public. But privately, he really, really invests in people, and he cares about them deeply. But he also teaches immersion as the best way to learn anything, to accomplish just about anything. And so at his average event, it's a 15-hour day. And he is sometimes on stage for the entire 14 to 15 hours. In our particular case, it just built upon. And you do accomplish so much more when you're in state and you're focused on something and you're accomplishing, you know, what you want to accomplish. And he was able to learn, you know, pretty much everything about our business as a business within that 14-hour period. Enough so he says, look, we got to be partners. I think I can add value to the company. I also agreed with that. And ultimately, he's been a fantastic partner, along with his son, Josh, who's been instrumental in this, and AJ Gupta, who runs his family office with Tony. You know, they're dear friends, and they've been immensely valuable through this entire process.
Absolutely. Okay, so your business partners, he's investing with your firm, and then your partners. Now you've co-written this book, The Holy Grail of Investing. And, you know, the cool thing about Tony, I mean, to your point, you know, he's larger than life, but he's out to serve people, right? Like that's been my experience. I mean, even just with a lot of his products, like you can go to a conference or a workshop, and like some of those things get very pricey, but you can also buy one of his books, and for $10 or $20, you're getting 95% of his insights and tips and strategies are almost for free. Or if you go to YouTube, heck, they are for free. But he's very generous, I think, in that way, just sharing information. And I also thought he's generous in the book, in the sense, right from the beginning, he kind of comes out and says, hey, I'm not a financial genius, right? I've been fortunate that I've been able to work with a lot of the world's most successful investors, from Ray Dalio now to Christopher to you as well. So, I mean, really the strategies in the book, they're ones that he's learned from guys like you, from asset managers like you. So in a nutshell, then, The Holy Grail of Investing, I mean, that's a title that kind of makes a big promise, you know? Begs the question, what is the Holy Grail of investing?
So I'll answer the question, but I do want to give Tony one other piece of credit that I don't think enough people give him credit for. He is one of the most philanthropic people that I've ever been around. And that's one of the reasons why we decided that 100% of the profits from this book will go to Feeding America. So, you know, he has a 100 billion meal challenge to feed 100 billion people a meal. And that's a big challenge. And all the proceeds from the book, profits from the book, will go to that. So the Holy Grail of Investing, you know, for those that are in the industry, they're familiar with it most because of a guy by the name of Harry Markowitz. Harry Markowitz won the Nobel Prize in 1990 for the whole concept of, if you take non-correlated or less correlated asset classes and you blend them together, you can actually reduce your risk and potentially increase your return. Well, that concept is what now most people call modern portfolio theory. Well, Ray Dalio took that to another level and obviously is built the largest hedge fund business in the world. And Ray has done a great job of educating in not academia words, but in common English, of what really the Holy Grail of Investing is. And it's 8 to 15 non-correlated assets or low correlation assets combined together in a portfolio. You know, that's what we want to do to get across in the book, is that every single investor can accomplish this. Now, there are some people out there that really just love a roller coaster without a seatbelt, and they just want to go up and down and have all this volatility in their life. But what we actually were able to show in the book and in some of the other materials we have is that you can get the same return with potentially 80% less volatility risk, 80% less risk and the same return. That's a much smoother ride on that roller coaster, which most investors need. And then if you're willing to take a little more risk, if you're willing to go into the private markets, into things that are less liquid, you can actually increase your returns dramatically while keeping that risk potentially much lower. And so, you know, I use the example for people. It's just trying to make it to where every single person gets out of the academic worlds and out of the finance speak, if you will. If you had a golf shop and you only sold one thing in your golf shop and you only sold rain gear and that's all you did, well, there's some days you're going to sell a lot of rain gear. Some days you're not going to sell any rain gear. If all you sold was sunscreen, then some days you're going to sell a lot, some days you're going to sell very little. But if you have both, you're going to have a smoother revenue line and you're going to have less volatility to your sales. Well, naturally, if you take that to 8 to 15 products, you're going to get more diversification of your revenue stream. That is true for an investor. If you have the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ and that's your whole diversification, you're not diversified. If you have the NASDAQ and the S&P and you have some bonds and you have some private credit and you have some real estate and you have some professional sports and you have GP stakes and you have enterprise software and venture technology, it's healthcare, et cetera. Now, something's zigging and zagging at almost, you know, different times, almost all the time, which means that you're not beholden to just what happens to the Magnificent Seven or any other large concentration of public stocks.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, there's a couple different threads there that you mentioned, Christopher, that I want to follow up on. I mean, you know, the diversification, the free lunch, obviously that's the bedrock of modern investing, right? Any financial advisor worth his or her salt is going to make that just a foundational concept. Another thing you alluded to was that illiquidity premium, you know, and that's where I read about David Swensen and the Yale Endowment Fund, and that really captured my imagination, I think, when I was younger as an investor. And I've never really shook that concept. You know, it's really stuck with me, the idea of if you're willing to accept that, you know, illiquidity, if you're able to accept in some cases, you have that opportunity to potentially achieve higher returns. So how much of the Holy Grail is about the diversification and the non-correlation versus, you know, being in illiquid or private markets and earning some additional, would you call it alpha, you know, just by being private?
So we tried to cover both. We tried to make sure that we educated on what the Holy Grail of investing is and the diversification concept. But where we really felt that we could add the most value, because Ray Dalio has done such a good job with lots of videos, et cetera, that kind of explain it for those that want to dig in there. But they're just, most people don't know enough about the private markets. And so that's where we spent most of our time with the educational sections about what is private equity, what is a GP stake, what is enterprise software, what is real estate, how do you invest in it, et cetera. And then the back is the interviews that we did with the titans of the industry. But what I think people really don't fully appreciate is the times are changing rapidly, where not only can a lot more people invest in alternative investments now than ever before because of rule changes in Congress, but also there's a lot more availability of things that have at least some level of liquidity. May only be quarterly liquidity, may only be semi-annual liquidity, or even annual liquidity. But there's a lot of new solutions because of the rule changes in the governance of our country, in particular in the U.S., to where people now can do that. It's coming for 401k plans. Don't know when it's going to be here, but it's in the works, and it's not long. And so people need to understand where it fits, the pros and the cons, and what everything is about it, and how it can potentially help them in their portfolio. I mean, when you look at private equity, and just to put it into your audience's perspective, you know, private equity has outperformed the public markets for 35 of 35 years, and the compounded annual returns 500 basis points more, 9% basically round numbers to 14%. Well, you start talking about $1 million growing to $27 million or $1 million growing to $120 million. Well, I kind of like the $120 million better. So round numbers. But the whole point is that these strategies, most people have never been exposed to. And as you said, most investment advisors, you know, will, you know, talk about diversification and they will build that. But in the traditional public markets, correlations are so much higher than people realize. 2022 was really a wake-up call for people. It's one of the reasons why we really wanted to get this book out, is that bonds and stocks both got crushed at the same time in 2022. It was the worst performing 60-40, 60% stocks, 40% bonds that we'd seen in literally almost 100 years. So because of that, people are like, what do I do? Just owning the S&P and mid-caps and small-caps and international used to be enough because they didn't really move together. Now, because of index funds and other passive investing, it's kind of everybody's all the way in or they're all the way out at the same time. Mm-hmm. So the private markets can really add so much diversification. I mean, professional sports is a good example. It really does not matter at all what happens to the S&P of what happens to the value of a professional sports team over a full cycle. Their business model is totally differentiated in the way that it doesn't rely on the same stuff. And that would be true of a lot of these other sectors as well. And we really wanted to get that across to the audience, because the other thing that's coming that I do think is important for the audience to know is that right now, the way the laws are written, you have to be a very successful rich person or somebody at least who makes a lot of money to even invest in these things. Right. So you have to be an accredited investor or qualified purchaser. So I personally, and Tony agrees with this, I think it's wrong that somebody who's a police officer who's chosen to protect us, who makes $85,000 a year, is not allowed by law to invest in something that might be better for them. Now, they still need to understand it. They still need to have the sophistication. So the good news is that the House of Representatives passed a bill, that says that the SEC has to create a test that would enable anyone to take a test to be able to become an accredited investor. So right now, it's sitting in committee at the Senate. We hear that it's going to be picked up there. I mean, it passed 372, if I remember correctly, to like 50 in the House. That's like nothing's that bipartisan in the House of Representatives.
Right.
So this is something that people support. It will be out there. And so if somebody is willing to take the test, put in the time, they'll be able to invest in everything we talk about in the book.
Right. And Christopher, I mean, the thing is with, first of all, with the accredited investor definition, was not pegged to inflation, which if you kind of zoom out and have any mathematical or financial knowledge at all, you kind of realize, well, that's just silly to begin with. Although I guess it's a good thing, right? Because it does sort of slowly broaden the pool of who's an accredited investor. Also, you know, pegging it to income is not really a good approximation of someone's financial sophistication, right? Just go talk to all your physician friends about hedge funds and private equity real estate, you know, to understand that those two things don't necessarily sync up. I mean, the good news is there's also Reg CF and the crowdfunding and, you know, Section 506C and the different exemptions. So there's a general broadening, a general trend towards democratization. But the expansion of the accredited investor definition, that would be a big lever. And to your point, it really does have bipartisan support, right? Because I can argue that from the conservative pro-business, supply side, whatever point of view, but I could also frame the whole thing as, investors' rights or, you know, standing up for the little guy and having access to these same types of investments that the super rich have access to, right?
I mean, it's to me personally, and I get very passionate about this. You have a PhD who's brilliant, but they work for a non-for-profit and they make $100,000 a year and they're not allowed to invest in something, but yet there's somebody who inherited a whole bunch of money simply because they're in the right family and they don't have a clue. That's just to me wrong. It's something that needs to be fixed, and I'm confident that the Senate will make that happen and enable people to be able to, again, they got to know what they're doing. But we also, as a result of that, and it goes back to one of the interesting other points that you made. So there is more of a democratization that is happening, but most of the things that the quote unquote smaller investor is going to see in many cases is very, very risky, very, very volatile, and potentially has already been passed on by all of the major institutional investors. I mean, literally the press release hit yesterday. We wrote a $1 billion check on Monday, right? The press release hit. So if something is interesting to us, we're going to see it. If somebody wants our money, they're going to bring it to us. We look at 1,500 investments a year. The vast majority of people that are investing right now in alternative investments that are just, you know, the average investor, they hear about in the locker room at the club, or they hear about somebody hits them with a post online. And now, oh, I can get into this one. That's great. What we want to do is to open up the aperture to where people of all sizes can invest in the very best, not just what they can get into.
Right. And you know, I've been a little bit critical of crowdfunding in the past or some of this stuff in the sense that, to your point, first of all, the deal flow, by the time it sort of trickles down, maybe everybody's passed on the deal and it ends up, you know, on a crowdfunding platform or whatever. And then a lot of times just to like the distribution mechanism of the market is going to necessitate higher fees. And by the time you tack on fees on top of fees on top of fees, you know, some of these options for the little guy, so to speak, it's like, well, just the fee structure itself already sort of crowds out any illiquidity premium or any alpha. But one other interesting point that you made, Christopher, you know, with alternative investments, that is what we're looking for, is aside from the illiquidity premium, you know, earning higher returns from being willing to go illiquid. We're also looking for less correlation to those typical big, broad asset classes, stocks and bonds. But I'm a big proponent that you have to go under the hood. You can't just hear alternative investment, so therefore it's not correlated to the markets, because the truth is there's a spectrum, and along that spectrum, right, you have higher correlation, lower correlation, little correlation, no correlation. I mean, the real holy grail, negative correlation, is rare, right? It's very, very rare. So among the different asset classes that you talk about in the book, I mean, which ones of those would you point to that are really very low correlation, or you know, you mentioned, I think, sports franchises were one. Are there any others that you'd point to that, like, if I'm really looking to add low correlation to my portfolio?
So the one that I would add to that most easily would be GP Stakes. And GP Stakes stands for General Partner. General Partner Stakes means in a typical private equity fund or private credit fund or real estate, et cetera, you have the general partner who manages the assets. You have the limited partners who are the people that give them money to manage. And, you know, it could be big institutions, the CalPERS, the Texas Teachers of the world, et cetera. So the GP is going to get paid typically a 2% management fee and 20% of the profits. Some are higher, lower than 2. Some are higher, lower than 20. But the average is around that, you know, that 2 and 20 that people think about. Mm-hmm. So when you buy a fund, when you invest in a fund, you're paying the 2 and you're paying the 20 because these are experts who hopefully are going to deliver a good return for you. When you actually own a piece of the firm, you actually are earning a portion of the 2% and earning a portion of the 20%. And so therefore, you have a very different risk profile. Now, more importantly than all of that is that the management fees are contractual. As you've talked about, illiquidity. If you get into a private equity fund, it typically, not all, but most of them, they have no liquidity until you get out. It's kind of like if you buy, you know, your local business, you're going to own it until you don't. Well, right. So during the entire period of that ownership, you're paying that general partner 2%. That general partner is earning that 2% from all of their investors. So it's contractual, usually for 5 years, sometimes as long as 10 years. And I will tell you, if you know exactly what your revenue is going to be for the next 5 years, it's pretty easy to budget, which means you're usually very profitable. And so the reason why it's so much less correlated is this reason. Because of those contractually obligated management fees, and because of the fact that you own everything that they have, that they've sponsored, that's in the ground today, everything they're doing in the future forever, everything they own now, everything they do today, and everything in the future, you literally have what we call cross-cycle diversification or vintage diversification. You know, people start thinking, hearing vintage diversification, think about wine, but it's actually a really good example. If you're a collector of wine and all you do is buy the 2012, it may be the perfect year or maybe a lousy year. If you buy the 12, the 13, the 14, the 15, the 16, you're going to get the best and the worst, but it's diversification. Same is true if you invest with a firm that launched a fund 5 years ago and a fund 3 years ago and a fund last year, and they're raising another one. Well, some of those are going to be better than others. Right. But when you own the firm, you actually have this cross-cycle diversification that means you're always going to get the management fees on all of the assets, and the ones that do really, really well, you're going to get the carried interest, the 20% of the profits. And then obviously, as long as the business grows, you get the value increase in the business itself. Some of the firms that we own stakes in, as an example, they've gone from $13 billion to $100 billion in assets under management. And that obviously increases enterprise value quite dramatically. That's why it's just really not correlated to the general markets. It has some, like everything, sure, generally speaking, but very, very low.
So, I mean, you know, if I could wake up tomorrow and have a GP stake and some great asset managers, that'd be great, right? But, it, you know, and I think that's very common in the family office world. Let's say maybe on a fund level, like GP of a fund, not necessarily of the asset management firm as a whole. But, you know, if I'm managing a family office and I want to invest a big chunk into a fund as a limited partner, as a passive investor, I can write a $20 million check, but I can call the fund manager and say, hey, given the size of this check and that this is 25% of the whole raise or whatever, I want you to cut me in a slice of the GP of that fund, right? So that kind of arrangement is pretty common. But what you're talking about is owning an equity piece of that entire, you know, asset management firm. How does a normal, everyday Jane or Joe investor, how do they get access to owning some of a GP?
So it's very, very difficult, but there are managers that specialize and focus in this, but they typically have very, very, very high minimums. And it's, you know, one of the reasons why we have become so large in what we are doing is because, you know, we're the second largest or first largest, depending on who you ask, allocator to GP stakes in the world. And it is through that democratization, if you will, that we're able to provide access to people of all different sizes and shapes into owning a piece of a private asset management firm. We're one of the very few places that that can occur, but there are others. And it's something to where someone should obviously evaluate everybody who's doing it and say, who do I want to partner with? But they have to know where to look. And so a big part of what we wanted to do with this book was to make sure that people knew that something was out there, that maybe it's a fit for them, maybe it's not. But at least they'll know it exists, because most people are not participating in the vast majority of the economy. It's something really interesting that was a statistic that came out recently. 87% of all of the companies in the United States that do more than $100 million of revenue, 87% of them are private, not public. We all think of the Apples and Amazons and Googles of the world that, of course, are huge and they're great businesses. But if you look at what actually drives the economy, the 87% that does so much of the job creation and obviously such a share of GDP, the vast majority of people never participate in anything there except for their own business. We really want to help change that, because we want people to participate in the entire economy, not just the very, very largest businesses in the economy.
Yeah, and I mean, to your point, that's where a lot of the wealth creation is occurring, is in the private markets. And it's kind of a shame in the sense that it's like table stakes to have a certain amount of wealth already built, right? To then participate in the private markets, where to your point, there's that delta of additional alpha that they're earning year after year, and the compounding effect of that over time is tremendous, right?
It is. And the one thing that I want to give a little bit of positive hope, if you will, to your audience, is that there's so many other ways they can do private assets that don't require qualified purchaser status, the accredited investor status. There's a lot more that's available right now. And in particular, most people think, if I want a coupon, I got to buy a muni bond, or I got to buy a government bond or a corporate bond. The private credit world is so much more accessible to people now than it ever was before. Some of that is literally listed on the exchange, and most people don't even know it. So it's publicly traded. It can trade every day. It's still an alternative asset, but it actually has daily liquidity. It's the private credit world. In the case of private credit as a whole, for the last decade, literally, private credit has on average generated over a 9% return. The public markets, the daily liquidity bonds, plain vanilla, the average bond that has generated a zero rate of return over that same 10-year period of time. 9% versus zero. I think I'd like 9 better. But you don't have to give up a ton of liquidity to access that, sometimes quarterly, sometimes, you know, once a year. But most people can take some portion of their portfolio that doesn't have to be daily liquid. And if so, they can access a lot better potential returns.
Yeah. And to your point, Christopher, a lot of these alternative investment funds that used to have 5-year lockups, I mean, some funds even longer than that, there's all sorts of intermittent liquidity products now, right? Where it may not be daily, you know, it could be daily liquidity, but it could also be quarterly or annual or monthly liquidity. Or so there's more of a spectrum. There are so many more options. Well, the strategies, I mean, this stuff, again, this is very near and dear to my heart. The private markets, and I do think that, you know, you're preaching to the choir, so to speak, Christopher, both myself and I think honestly a lot of my audience, you're preaching to the choir. But I'm glad that you're so passionate about bringing that message to more and more retail investors. But I want to ask more just about the practical side of the book. What was it like to write a book with Tony Robbins? I mean, is that a lot of pressure? I imagine that it is a lot of pressure, no?
So it is a lot of pressure. Just anytime you write a book, you never have any idea if it's going to be well received or not. So you're putting yourself out there. But number two, you know, Tony and I wrote it as one voice. And we didn't want to have you write this, I write that, and have, you know, ping pong for the reader. So what we did is we wrote it together. And one of the gifts that Tony has is to be able to take really complex information and make it understandable and also interesting. for the reader. And obviously he's written, you know, 3 New York Times bestsellers before this one. And so he brought so much value to be able to say, okay, here's the concept we want to talk about from an investment perspective. And naturally, as the investment guy, I would make it a little too wonky and I would get into a little bit too, you know, deep weeds. And he's like, you know, look, we need to overly explain what it is we're trying to impart because of the fact that the average reader won't know those terms, that kind of thing. So collaborating on it was really a lot of fun. And it's something to where it made me better as a communicator to be able to think about it from the perspective of the audience more than I ever had before. And I know that, you know, Tony would say that it made him better thinking about it from an investment standpoint because we were able to utilize both of our, you know, gifts to be able to hopefully add a lot of value to the readers. And then, of course, the interviews with the titans that we interviewed, I mean, they're fascinating stories about their life and about what ultimately has led them to be able to be such strong performers, in some cases over 30% compounded annual rates of return for decades for their investors, what allowed them to do that and what allows them and what drives them, et cetera. So it was a lot of fun writing the book with Tony.
Well, Christopher, I want to get to the interviews in a second because I want to touch on some of the people there because you had your word titans, but I mean, absolutely some absolute legends in the book. But I also want to compliment the voice or the style of the book. That's interesting that you wrote it together because when I was reading it, well, a couple thoughts. First of all, I did not find it to be dumbed down. I think maybe there's a difference. Like to your point, Tony's a good communicator, kind of breaking down complex topics and making it understandable. But as a financial guy, I wasn't reading it and going like, this is, you know, it was using technical language in the sense that it was correct, right? There wasn't anything in there that I'm like, well, this is just mass market. Like, I think if you're a more sophisticated investor, you're still going to, you know, find a lot in this book. But another thing I will say, you know, because in your everyday, in your day job, you know, aside from being an author, obviously you're working with some institutional investors as well as family offices, ultra wealthy individuals. My experience with family offices, and I mean, they're all over the map in terms of strategy, temperament, philosophy, sophistication. But a lot of even ultra wealthy people, they are not sophisticated in terms of understanding all the different hedge fund strategies or all the idiosyncrasies of private equity. So I honestly think that's just an important skill for any asset manager to have, just that communication skill.
I totally agree. And it's something to where we have every single day almost somebody come in our office and, you know, their presentation is basically something along the lines of, you know, we went to great schools and we're great people and we're great at what we do. And here's our track record and we're great. And by the way, did I mention that we're great? And please give us your money. Well, that doesn't do it for most investors, right? So you need to be able to communicate the why behind it. And that was, and I appreciate what you said there, because the fact that we really did spend a ton of time taking, you know, not wanting to make it dumbed down to where it's elevated up to where a financial advisor, an investment professional, or a very sophisticated investor would get a lot of value at it. But at the same time, Tony was like, we need to explain that more. We need to, you know, explain what that acronym is. We need to not have people just have it go over their heads to where a broader, wider swath of the readership would be able to really enjoy it. So thank you for saying that. That was a key goal of ours. And when you think about the vast majority of people, they're never going to be able to be an expert in everything, nor should right. they be. But what they need to have is the skill set to be what we call in our firm, you know, find what matters, see the forest, not the trees. What is the key thing that's going to drive success for the investment? What is our philosophy as a firm? Number one, number two, number three, you know, consistent with Mr. Buffett is what's the worst case scenario? How do we look at the downside, get comfortable with that? Because if we can live with the worst case, the upside will take care of itself. Well, Mr. Buffett's famous for saying, you know, number one rule, don't lose money. Number two rule is see first rule. Okay. Well, we've run our firm for 23 years in that regard. And literally in the last 23 years, we've made money on 94% of all of the private investments that we've made, both realized and unrealized. And we're really proud of that. And it comes from this focus on risk first. And the vast majority of people approach alternative investing of how much can I make and what's in it, you know, going to be this next greatest thing and right. it's going to be awesome. And they put money in it and it vaporizes. And they're like, oh, how did that happen? oh, maybe you should have seen this, 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 and this, but they had profit goggles on. They had greed goggles on. We need people to look at the downside, and we wanted to help people see both the opportunities, but also to know where to look for risk, because that will set them up for success in whatever they invest in.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you mentioned Warren Buffett's rule number one and rule number two. I mean, that's a lesson that I've absorbed speaking with family offices. It's just that focus on capital preservation. And it's almost counterintuitive, because I think when, you know, kind of everyday investors, quote unquote, normal people, when you think about the ultra wealthy and how they invest, you might think, well, they're ultra wealthy. They can afford to take a ton of risk, you know, all of these outsized risks. But actually, I think in very many cases, there's a focus on capital preservation. And then when there is risk, or appetite for that excess risk, or whatever you want to call it, the more opportunistic investments. In the book, you talk about the asymmetric upside, right? Where, sure, I'm willing to take on a riskier investment. If it's a coin flip, and if it's heads, I get a 5x return, right? And if it's tails, I get my money back. You know, that kind of a mindset where I think normal investors, a lot of times, to them, it's a very binary. It's either I have my greed goggles on and I'm swinging for the fences and kind of throwing a caution to the wind, or I put it in a CD and, like, you know, keep up with inflation, right?
And that's exactly right. And it's unfortunate. And one of the things we really wanted to, you know, help people see is that you know, it's totally fine to take risk. Just know what risks you're taking. You know, one of the most interesting investments we've ever made is a company in Austin, Texas, by the name of Icon. They've gotten a lot of press because the founder was on 60 Minutes here a couple months ago. They print homes with a 3D printer, okay? And they're printing an entire neighborhood right now outside of Austin with a 3D printer. They're printing things on military bases. They've been hired by NASA, and, you know, just go watch the 60 Minutes episode. They've been hired by NASA to figure out how to do this remotely and place things on the moon, all right? Now, I don't know if that'll happen or not, but I know it's real revenue to the company, and I know that they are literally changing the way homes are being built. They can build a home in 2 days. 2 days, okay? In 100% concrete. So again, go to YouTube, watch, you know, Icon 3D printed homes, and you can learn a lot about it. But when we made the investment, we were a seed investor in the company. Literally, we were one of the first six investors. And we had a relationship with the team. We loved the team, we loved the concept, but we also knew that it could be a zero. And if things didn't go well, it would be a zero. So we told all of our investors, and I literally got right up into the camera during the webinar that we held and said, if you invest in this, you're literally setting your money on fire. If you're not okay with that, get off the call.
That's asymmetric, but right there,
that,
Christopher.
That's asymmetric.
Yes.
But if you if you are willing to take that risk and size it correctly in your portfolio, then you might just change the world. And, you know, who knows where we'll sell that business at some point, but it's a 30x right now on our return. And we are literally watching a revolution of how homes are being built in a company that we're a part of. And this is important to me personally, and Tony as well, because Tony was very involved with Icon even before we got involved, from the standpoint of philanthropic and building homes in Mexico for people that needed clean, safe housing, is, you know, they literally had the ability to eradicate much of the homelessness in our country because of the fact that you can print a home so fast, so inexpensively, and make it safe and make it clean. And it's something to where that is really cool to be a part of. But at the same time, you better be comfortable with the risk if you're going to take it, because you're not going to be able to have enough swings at the plate if you don't have a real respect for the downside.
And that goes back to the very first thing that you talked about, which is just the diversification and, you know, correctly sizing and combining assets to where some can zig and some can zag. And, you know, to an investment like that, whether we're talking venture or private equity, private real estate, the deal flow is important, right? Because again, a lot of the stuff that is trickling down to the retail market is not necessarily the cream of the crop in terms of deal flow. So, you know, I just appreciate your philosophy on that and trying to bring more accessibility to it. Well, I do want to talk briefly at least about the interviews, right? Because you've lined up, I mean, really just a who's who, or, you know, just a list. And not all of these people are extremely well known, like in the mainstream media, right? But these are like super investors that you interviewed in the book. Is that right?
That's right. And many of them are multi-billionaires that people have never heard of. And the reason why is because of the fact that they do not market themselves to the mass audience. They market themselves to a few institutions who give them all the capital that they need to manage. And in many cases, they manage $20, $30, $40, $100 billion, and people literally have never heard of them. Some are more well-known, like Robert Smith. Robert is, you know, the founder of Vista Equity Partners. You know, he's the wealthiest African-American in the country and the largest enterprise software investor in the world. He is very well-known because of his philanthropy, because of his profile. But then you have other people that are really well-known, like David Sachs, and he has his own podcast. He's part of the PayPal Original Investor Group. But then you have other people like, you know, Ramzi Mousallem, who I guarantee you prior to the book, 99.9% of the audience had never heard of. But yet he has literally got, according to most sources, he is the best performing private equity firm in the last two decades in almost every metric that you can imagine. And they don't know his personal story about when he started the firm and his partner was in it with him, committed suicide. And so literally the key man clause could have been triggered by all their investors and he would have been out of business. He went and met with every single one of his investors and convinced them why it was a good idea for them to keep the fund going. And the rest is history. Now, he's one of the wealthiest in the world, certainly one of the most successful in private equity history, and nobody knows who he is. So we have access to those because either we're partners with them, we're friends with them, or in some cases, we actually own stakes in their business. And we wanted to give them, the audience, the opportunity to hear from people. Again, Michael B. Kim, good example. He's the wealthiest person in Korea. He is the godfather of Asian private equity. And most people have never even heard of him. Mm-hmm. But yet he has changed the world of investing in Asia. So those are the kinds of opportunities we wanted to give exposure to. And it's just because of those relationships that we were able to do that.
Yeah, I love it. I love those kind of interviews with, you know, folks that maybe are a little, you know, off the beaten path, but at the same time, highly successful. And it's really, it's generous of them to be willing to be included in a book like this. And, you know, I appreciate Tony's humility and even yours, Christopher, the fact that, you know, you include those interviews, and it kind of speaks to the fact that you're upfront with all of us that, you know, you're learning from other investors, right? And I think that thirst for knowledge and willingness to seek knowledge, I mean, it's what makes for a good investing career, right, over the long run. I'm curious, which of the interviews, did any of them really surprise you, or where you really learned something new?
You know, I learned something from every single one of them. And what I will tell you is the interviews all had one common theme to them, which was really a little bit surprising to me. And that is that all of the people that we interviewed for the book, you know, they were so passionate about the value that they create, not just extracting value. You know, we hear about in the hedge fund world, as an example, it's all about extracting alpha. So in the public markets, it is a zero-sum game. If you lose, somebody's, you know, going to win. And if you win, somebody's got to lose. There's an other side to that trade. That is true. That's the nature of the beast. You're trying to extract alpha. In the case of almost everything in the private world, it's all about adding as much value as possible. So you take, you know, Robert Smith, the Vista playbook, which I knew very, very well because we do own a stake of Vista and been partners with them in a very significant way. They have a playbook that you just overlay on enterprise software companies, and it's just basically been there, done that. You need a new comp plan? Got it. This makes sense. You need a new pricing model? Got it. This makes sense. And being able to overlay that, and we heard that over and over and over, and in energy with Bob Zorich and Will Van Lowe. I mean, these folks, they know how to create value in the assets that they invest in. General Atlantic, Bill Ford, you know, just tremendous value, even on credit, which people don't think of. You know, David Golub talked a lot about how you can tremendously add value to the customer, which in some cases is a private equity firm, in other cases it's direct to a business, but you can add a lot of value to those businesses that adds jobs, that adds growth to the overall economy. That was the common theme. The most interesting, you know, part of it was how all of them had that same common thread also. They were just intellectually curious. They wanted to understand the why behind the why. And obviously, you think about somebody like professional sports, you know, oh, I understand professional sports, I get it. No, there's so much more to it that happens that people have no idea when they're just watching the Super Bowl the other night. There's so much more business that's happening behind the scenes. There's so much more streaming. There's so much more, you know, property development and all of that kind of thing. So that was the most surprising to me, because I knew most of their, you know, their businesses beforehand. But the other thing that I think the readers will really, really enjoy is that they were willing to open up, each one of them, to what made them who they are. And that's where Tony, you know, I obviously asked a lot more of the financial related questions of, you know, running your business, you know, creating value in what you're doing. And Tony got a lot more into their personal story about, okay, why are you one of the top in the world compared to the other really bright people that you compete with? What is it that sets you apart? And that is something that most people will never, ever get the opportunity to ask these folks in a one-on-one interview. Barry Sternlicht's on TV, you know, from Starwood. He's on TV a lot, and he talks so much about what's going on in the investment world, and he's really good at it. But nowhere will he get into a CNBC interview in a typical fashion about what happened as he was growing up that made him successful and how he built Starwood to be the behemoth that it is today. That's really fascinating for people to be able to read.
Yeah, totally. And I think that kind of high level, more inspirational side of it, that is not unimportant, right? Like the what motivates people, what drives them to become excellent. I mean, that maybe is one of the most important lessons for each of these people, because they're all exceptional people, right? To your point, and each of them in a unique way, but there's that common thread. Well, Christopher, you've been so generous with your time. To go ahead.
I want to tell you one story real quickly, because sure. The fact that it's somebody that I think ties into what you just said so perfectly. Vinod Khosla is known as one of the most successful investors of all time. We also had Tony Florence from NEA. They're the granddaddy. But you know, Vinod Khosla is a legend in his own specific right, because he was first money into this company you probably heard of by the name of Google. He was first money into, you know, companies that most people know today. He turned a $7 million investment in Juniper Networks into $4 billion. But most people have no idea that he actually literally drove across the country the day classes began, because he wore out the admissions director at Stanford to be able to go to attend that school. When somebody dropped out, he was literally on the East Coast at another school. He literally withdrew, drove all the way all night to be able to enroll in classes the next day, because he was literally doing paper routes and everything else to be able to make ends meet. And now he's one of the wealthiest in the world. And he showed that grit and determination and that vision to become something that he knew he wanted to be. And he was just willing to do what it took in order to accomplish that.
I love it. And it's inspirational stuff, right? It's not always easy to make investing. Like, I think it is, it excites me, but I think you and Tony have done a great job to make this stuff inspirational, but at the same time, including concrete technical things that I think investors need to understand. And Christopher, I think we've just scratched the surface, so I'd love to have you back on the show at some point to talk some more. But in the meantime, where's the best place to pick up the new book, The Holy Grail of Investing?
It's available at all the major sites, obviously Amazon, Barnes & Noble, et cetera. It's online there. You can go to, yeah, theholygrailofinvesting.com is the actual website for the book. And obviously, we'd be more than happy to, you know, have everybody go, you know, get the book. And then obviously, we'd be more than happy to talk about kind of how this gets applied in somebody's life.
Absolutely. So. And as you listen or watch the show, it's available now. It just came out today. So head on over to Amazon or your favorite bookstore and grab a copy. Christopher, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me. I'll be happy to come back anytime.
That's it for today's show. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to help spread the word to other investors. And we'll be back soon with another episode.